Well, Roger, we've talked about how in the early days you started thinking about cosmology when people really knew absolutely nothing about cosmology at all. There was hardly anything about the stars that people could see. Now it's completely different. There's absolutely gigantic amounts of data and huge numbers of people poring over them in every way. But you, I think, would feel that some quite fundamental things haven't really been answered at all. I mean, the role of the cosmological constant and then the origin of the tell me how you think things stand at the moment.
Well, I suppose I must think about things somewhat differently because the problems that I've regarded as important over the years attain scant attention these days. Well, I've always been very puzzled by the second law of thermodynamics and the direction of time and all that. And, well, there are various things that it has to do with, which maybe are offshoots in one way or another, like how one conscious perception relates to it, but let's leave that aside for the moment. The main thing, which is a pretty obvious thing in a way, but which is almost totally ignored. Now, you see, we're supposed to have this Big Bang origin of the universe. And if entropy, which is this measure of disorder, is increasing with time, which is what the second law tells us, that means, well, okay, it's understandable if I have a glass of water and I splash it, it goes on the ground and you don't see the opposite. That's entropy increasing, you don't see the entropy decreasing. But if you state this the other way around, it's the same statement, but just phrased in the opposite direction, it means as you go back in time, things get more and more and more ordered. Entropy goes down and down and down. And where do you get? Well, you get to this thing called the Big Bang. And what's the best piece of evidence for the Big Bang? Well, it's this microwave background. You see this radiation coming from all directions. And this microwave background has one very important characteristic feature, as noticed very early on by the COBE mission, that you see thermal equilibrium. You see this beautiful spectrum, the Planck spectrum, which indicates that what you're looking at was in thermal equilibrium. Well, it's not equilibrium really because it was expanding, but taking that into account, that expansion is not an entropy increasing expansion, it's adiabatic expansion. And Tolman, the American cosmologist and physicist, fully appreciated that, that you were looking at something which was in effect thermal equilibrium. Now that is, on the face of it, a paradox, because surely when you go back in time, if the entropy is going down and down and down, it ought to be pretty small. Yet what you see is something telling you the entropy was at its maximum. Now, it's never been said, you know, this is a great puzzle. Who says that? Well, I've been saying it, but hardly anybody else. Not only that, they don't say that, but they say this is what you expect. In the standard cosmological models, if you take completely random initial state, that's what you get, and that's what you expect. And yeah, sure. And that, you know, when they saw, when Penzias and Wilson saw this thing, Dickey and people would say, yeah, well, that's what we expected to see. It's just the flash of the Big Bang you're seeing. Well, what about the entropy? How can that be? Well, I think there's a sort of irony here, because people tried to solve the Einstein equations for cosmology. And how do you solve them? Well, you assume symmetry, because otherwise the equations are just too hard to solve. And Friedman did this. He just assumed you have a very homogeneous isotropic universe, and now he was able to solve the equations. Einstein was rather unhappy with his equations initially, but nevertheless, he did it right. Einstein agreed with his mathematics, but he thought there must be something wrong somewhere. But it's curious that it's these models which have been what people have used ever since. And since they use them, it's just, they think this is cosmology. And the fact that this is such an incredible assumption, it doesn't sort of hit people. And this is where the entropy is low. It's because all the ripples in the space-time that could have been there weren't there. And they were initially assumed not to be there because it's the only way they could solve the equations. But then you get used to the idea they're not there because those are the models. But why weren't they there? All these degrees of freedoms in the gravitational field could have been there. And to see how extraordinary this assumption is, you think of a collapsing universe, which has all the irregularities which might be there, forms black holes, these black holes congeal, the entropy goes soaring up incredibly. Now that we have this Bekenstein-Hawking formula for the entropy in a black hole, we now can make an estimate for how big that entropy is and how improbable the universe that we actually find ourselves to be in.
So I can see you might have had that puzzle even before the big and microwave background was discovered, because
yes.
That was attracted you to the Hoyle steady state model as a way of getting out of the Friedman.
It's true that there, I
that,
thought
that
about
true?
The. Yeah. You see, I did think about the second law issue very much in connection with the steady state model, but there, yeah, it was something that I'd worried about. But then it seemed that the problem could be solved with the picture that they have, with the hydrogen being uniformly distributed. Mm. And then as it clumps into stars, that gives you an increase in the entropy. It's the right idea, but it's with the wrong model. You see, you have a model with the hydrogen produced uniformly, and as it clumps, it produces these hot spots. It's the action of gravity.
Yes.
Gravity produces hot spots, and the sun is a hot spot, and the dark sky, and it's not that the sun is hot, the sun is bright, gives us our life on the Earth, because if the whole sky was the same temperature as the sun, it would be totally useless. It's the combination of the hot sun and the dark sky, and that's where the low entropy resides, and that comes about through gravity. So it was this crucial thing, which, yeah, already when I was thinking about steady state, I must have been thinking about that, although I can't quite pinpoint that. But that's true. I did
yes.
worry about second law then. But the fact that the hydrogen was...
Did Dennis Chalmers think about that at all? Because that's the sort of thing which...
I don't remember
particularly...
Yeah. Yes, he should have. But, well, I wrote this article for the Hawking... No, not for the... Well, Hawking Israel were the editors, the Einstein Centenary volume.
Yes.
And this was... I put this long article about the second law of thermodynamics. Mm-hmm. I don't think I had discussed all those things with Dennis beforehand. But I didn't have the... particular idea that I had subsequently then.
Yes.
I didn't know how to characterize the particular way in which the Big Bang was special.
And that really comes out of studying the conformal structure. I mean, that's one thing. That's
yes.
That
yes.
In the earlier days, you wouldn't have
I think
attached
I had,
as much
yes.
importance to as you
yes.
would subsequently. Is it?
Well, there were a number of things I noticed very early on which played very important roles later on, but I couldn't figure out early. See, one of them is this fact, just a curious fact in mathematics. We're talking about four dimensions, and we're talking about space-time, for one time, three space, and we're talking about the Weyl curvature. Now, the Weyl curvature is a conformal curvature, so if you have a metric, you don't know what the scale of things is, but you know what angles are, or if you know what the light cones are, that's another way of saying the same thing. That conformal structure tells you where the light cones are, but you don't know big from small. Then the characterization of the curvature is in this Weyl curvature, W-E-Y-L. And the Weyl curvature is a measure of the conformal curvature. But it's also, in a sense, a measure of the gravitational degrees of freedom. Now, in connection with twisters, but not specifically twisters, I think I was thinking about it before that, because I was looking at how you write in spinners the zero rest mass field equations for all the different spins. It was basically Dirac, and though I had it, although when he did the zero mass case, for some reason he did it a different way, which I never fully understood. But if you followed up Dirac's earlier paper and did it for zero mass, that's what you get. You have this particular way of writing the different spins. And the Maxwell equations, you've just got two indices, and then you the graviton equation, if you like, you've got four indices. It's just the same equation. Neutrino equation is just one, if you consider it massless. And so the gravitational field is propagates, and there's this wave equation. I had this interesting, talking about slightly anecdotal things. Dirac never talked much, but I was a fellow at St. John's College at the same time as Dirac, and I remember at one point asking him whether I could have a chat with him about some of the stuff, you see, because I knew he was interested in quantizing general relativity. And so he agreed, and so he went off and had this, and I started describing this spinner stuff to him. And I had this equation, this wave equation for the for the spin two field, you see. And I said, so I wondered if this might have anything to do with quantization.
The two spinners which he had introduced.
Which he'd introduced, yes, I mean, absolutely. Yeah, introduced, yeah. Well, he didn't introduce the idea.
Well, no, but he had introduced to you.
Yeah. Absolutely, that's right. And so he said, is this any use of quantization? Well, I don't know, you have to have a Hamiltonian with this company. So I was slightly, but then the other thing about this equation, he said, well, where does that, he said to me, where does that equation come from? I said, well, it comes from the Bianchi identities. And he said, what are the Bianchi identities? And I thought, what? You don't know what the Bianchi, you see, yeah, and here he'd been doing all this quantization. Well, you see, he obviously knew them, he just didn't know they were called the Bianchi identities. He knew the contracted ones, because of all, and it was curious that, I mean, I guess he somebody who worked very much on his own too, so he knew all these equations, but he had no idea that those were called the Bianchi identities. And that's a slight odd extra story. But the point was, this came later, but the realization that you had this propagation equation, which made the gravitational equations look just like Maxwell equations, but for spin two rather than spin one. I mean, this was done already by Pauli and Fiertz or something, but they didn't do it this way. They did it in a much more complicated looking way. But if you write it in two spinners, it becomes completely obvious. But then I started worrying about the conformal invariance of these equations. And I was just struck by this curious fact that equation is conformally invariant with a particular weighting, conformal weighting for the spinner. And we already have the interpretation of the Weyl curvature as being the conformal curvature. And therefore, it has another conformal interpretation. So it's a conformal object. But the weighting is different. Mm. You have two different conformal weightings. And it just struck me, there's something important here. And I had no idea what it was. Well, so it was only much, much later when I realized it is absolutely crucial in a certain way, which comes to this leap ahead.
Yes,
cosmology.
Now coming on to most recent.
Well, you were asking me about second law and what I thought was important. And this big problem, you see, for a long, long time, I just thought, like everybody else, that the Big Bang, to understand it, we need quantum gravity. I mean, that's the conventional view. We need quantum gravity. Maybe it's string theory quantum gravity, maybe it's loop quantum gravity, maybe it's this kind of quantum gravity, or the other kind of quantum gravity, or twisted quantum gravity, but it's quantum gravity. Now, that means to me, or meant to me, quantum gravity must be a jolly funny theory, because the singularity, you see, one of the reasons you're studying quantum gravity is to explain the Big Bang singularity. Where do you see other singularities? Black holes. They're utterly, completely different. People used to say, well, you know, you've got singularities in the black holes, and doesn't that tell you you've got singularities in the Big Bang? You've got singularities in the Big Bang, therefore in the black holes. Just the same thing, time's going the other way around. But it's not. They're utterly different. But it's this entropy thing. The singularities in black holes are absolutely wild. The curvature, Weyl curvature goes completely dominates, Weyl's oscillates all over the place. Complete madness. In the Big Bang, calm as you could imagine. Think of the Big Bang as a great violent thing, but it's utterly regular. Gravitational degrees of freedom simply not activated. Now, what kind of quantum gravity is going to give you these two utterly different extremes in the black hole? Complete domination by the Weyl curvature. In the Big Bang, Weyl curvature seems to be zero, or at least very, very suppressed. My view then was to say, oh, well, quantum gravity must be a jolly funny theory with the time, not time asymmetric, and if we're going to find quantum gravity theory, you've got to put in time asymmetry somewhere, you see. So that was my view until, well, I guess about 8 or 9, I forget how long ago now it was, 8 or 9 years ago, I just had this idea. I was thinking about... Well, it took me a long time to be persuaded, when I say a long time, maybe about 3 years, to be persuaded that the observations of these distant supernovae made by Perlmutter and Schmidt and Riess had convincingly showed that the universe is accelerating in its expansion. And it was all sort of touted as being this totally mysterious thing that nobody could understand, totally unexpected. Yes. And I should say, well, go and look at all the cosmology books. Cosmological constant. Yeah. It's in all the cosmology books. I don't know why they thought it was mysterious. Why it should...
I think we should explain. We're talking about dark energy. That's right, which dark we think energy. Is neither dark nor energy.
Nor energy. It's a very bad name. Very bad name. But nevertheless, it's what people call it. And it's there, apparently. Fits in absolutely perfectly, as far as we know now, with what the term Einstein introduced in 1917 for admittedly the wrong reason. I mean, he wanted a static universe.
Well, half of it's right, and that's the only it's the only modification you can make that's generally covariant.
Absolutely, I mean,
it's not just a term.
It's not just a term. It is the one thing you can do to general relativity without wrecking it, basically. Yes, without changing it in a radical way. That's right. And so often I would take into consideration in asymptotics, the work I did in trying to look at squashing infinity down and making infinity look like a finite boundary. And you can use the conformal invariance of Maxwell's equations or of this equation that you get for the propagation of gravitons, if you like. It tells you how to study radiation field by looking at infinity. And I also knew that if there was a cosmological constant, which was positive, this surface would be space-like. It would be null if it's zero cosmological constant, time-light if it's negative cosmological constant. Fortunately, it's not negative, because that causes all sorts of problems, even though the string theorists seem to like it. the positive cosmological constant is a completely different class of problems. I used to think it had bad features. On reflection, it seemed to me they were just unusual features. But now it was absolutely crucial, because I was thinking about the very remote future and how boring it was going to be in the very remote future. All the black holes eventually disappear by Hawking evaporation, and there's nothing left of any interest, and this goes on to eternity. But to me, eternity is not such a long time, because I'm used to thinking of compressing it down by these conformal scalings.
This is what I mean by defeating time in more than one way, Roger.
Yes. Well, anyway, the argument was basically... I mean, I tend to use this in lectures as a sort of joke, but it's a real argument, you know, that the universe gets so incredibly boring that there won't be any of us around to be bored by it. Mainly it's photons, and you can't bore photons very easily. And so photons just go straight into this boundary. And the picture I was having and getting very used to was the idea of a boundary, which if you've just got massless things, that boundary is like anywhere else. And then the thought occurred to me, well, you've got a space-like boundary for the Big Bang. Why don't you put them together? So it's an outrageous thought, and I gave lectures on this, usually being careful to call it an outrageous idea before anybody else said it was outrageous. But as the years went by, I began to think more. Well, I think originally I would have given it a reasonable chance of being right. Reasonable chance, maybe not 50%.
There's more substance, isn't there, through Paul Todd's work and the...
Paul Todd, yes. See, Paul Todd, I had the thing I called the Weyl curvature hypothesis, which was to say that the Weyl curvature, as just a hypothesis, a way of characterizing the Big Bang, that it, as you have an initial type singularity like the Big Bang, the Weyl curvature should be zero. But that's awkward to say, because it's a singular state. What do you mean by a tensor when it's singular, and so on? So Paul had a much neater way of expressing it, which was to say, you stretch it out, stretch out the Big Bang by a conformal factor, which is something we did all the time for the Friedman models. That was quite a standard thing. But to make that the condition on the Big Bang, I think, is an important step. As Paul had it originally, it only makes the Weyl curvature finite, not necessarily zero. But as I already knew, the infinity, the Weyl curvature must be zero because of the way these things scale, as I said before. Because there's a conformal factor in the scaling, it must scale the Weyl curvature to zero. So if you stick them together, the zero Weyl curvature must propagate through to be zero on the next eon. So I'd started playing around with these ideas. half thinking it was completely crazy, I suppose, and half thinking it's probably right.
And we end up with looking for circles in the sky, which is absolutely, actually something we can actually see, something to do with the Möbius transformations on the sphere. What could be more beautiful as a prediction?
It's, well, you see, I was beginning, this didn't occur immediately. I was trying, people would ask me about, how could you tell if this is right? And I thought sort of rather wrongly about gravitational radiation or something. But it was later that it occurred to me, what's the most violent thing that could happen that might be a signal getting through? And so I was thinking of these collisions between supermassive black holes. You see, we're on a collision course with Andromeda, the Andromeda Nebula, and it has a black hole which is, 20, 50 times bigger than ours. And we have a 4 million solar mass black hole, and it's got a bigger one. And they could, on our collision course, they might well capture each other, spiral around, boom. When they swallow each other up, there'll be one huge explosion in the form almost entirely of gravitational waves. And these gravitational waves, as I'm used to, you've got the boundary, they will come and they'll hit the boundary in a definite place. What will they do when they get through? Well, because of the scalings, they can't exist as gravitational waves on the other side. They have to scale down into another form. And the equations tell us that you have to have a new dark, again, the word dark isn't a very good one, but I think on the conformal cyclic cosmology scheme, which is what I'm talking about here, CCC, is this scheme tells us that the information in the gravitational waves propagates across, but in the form of disturbances in this initial dark matter. So you have dark material created, and it will be given a kick by this gravitational wave impulse.
So in fact, you have another prediction, apart from the circular features corresponding to the gravitational radiation, and you have a prediction for what dark matter will turn out to be, which is quite different.
That is true.
What people looking for in mine shafts.
I haven't shouted about that one particularly because, I mean, it's what I call the initial form of dark matter because it's massless originally. Mm-hmm. It has to be massless, but the equations also tell you that you have to grow mass, so that you can't keep massless. There's just an inconsistency. So the mass has to occur. It must be tied in with Higgs mechanisms and so on. It hasn't been as yet properly. But I think one has to understand more about particle physics. How does the Higgs mechanism, the creation of mass in the early universe, relate to the appearance of mass, which comes in from the equations that you have here?
This is another huge area of your thought, really, is how a conformal symmetry is broken and the different ways in which it's broken, which we see much more clearly by expressing things in twisted geometric terms. So you see the breaking explicitly, but there are all these different aspects to it.
I've always been in two minds about that, yes. I suppose the cosmological constant has changed a bit, because I used to think one of my minds was that you have if there's no cosmological constant, you have this sort of Poincaré group twisters, and that's you have a sort of exact sequence, and exact sequences play a big role in a lot of cohomology and twister theory and so on. But if you have a cosmological constant, you don't quite have an exact sequence, you have something which is invertible, and it changes one's attitude. So I think that was a shift. The cosmological constant took me a little while to get used to, but with the cosmology it becomes absolutely crucial. Yes. You can't do this cosmology without a cosmological constant. So you must have dark energy, as it's called, and you must have dark matter, as it's called, because there has to be a new created scalar material every time you go from one eon to the next. And so therefore, in order that it is not to pile up, it's got to decay away too. So it must, throughout the history of each eon, the dark matter decays away, which I believe there is some rather feeble evidence for. I don't know how much to trust it.
I see. It must decay rather than clump together, which could for a bit, but then it must eventually decay.
It must decay. Yeah, otherwise it will build up.
Yes.
And then it'll just build up from eon to eon, and then you won't have a way of propagating. So I think it's got to decay. But there are some... it's not, the evidence is not very strong, but I heard two bits of evidence. One was from a lecture given by Steven Weinberg when he seemed to suggest that the density, the proportion of dark matter was larger in the very early universe than it is now. Okay. The other thing I picked up on, now none of these things, neither of these things may be right, but I just picked up on them because they sort of fitted in with what I was thinking. The other one was there are observations of perannihilation, I think, in the region near the center, well, of positrons, I think that's what it is, that you see positrons or something in the region near the center of the galaxy.
And they were these decay products?
I think there is a view, it may not, there may be lots of views, that it may be a decay product of dark matter. I have no idea.
They're not directly into photons, they would go through a matter.
They go through, not photons, but some, I don't have strong views on that, but it would have to go eventually, yeah. So dark matter, yes. But then the other thing, there's a more recent thing too. it may explain lots of things, you see. Of course, that's all the better because there may be things that could contradict it, and if there are things that can contradict it, as Bondi used to say with the steady state model,
yes.
The beauty of the steady state model was that it could be contradicted, and of course it was.
Yes.
So one has to look out for these things. But there is this information which was released in March of this year, 2014, about these what are called BICEP 2 observations, where the claim is, or was, has been, that this is the smoking gun of inflation. I haven't said anything about inflation, but I should say that in this model of mine, CCC, inflation can't be there. It would spoil things. Inflation is supposed to have been this exponential expansion, which is supposed to have taken place in the very, very early stages of the universe. Initially, the reasons put forward were ones that I always thought were just incorrect, having to do with the uniformity of the universe. And that only works if you've got a uniformity there originally. It doesn't. You can see from general arguments that can't be an argument. There are good reasons, though, that kept inflation going. One of them being the scale invariance of the fluctuations in temperatures that you see in the microwave background. And if you don't have inflation, you need another explanation. So to me, in a sense, there was inflation. That was the exponential expansion of the eon prior to ours, which is similar to an idea that Veneziano put forward some years before this scheme of mine. So it's not a bad idea.
But there are now much stronger constraints on what the inflationary, for people who... For inflation is on what they can viably believe.
Well,
the
B modes that they claim to see, these are polarization, photon polarizations that are seen, and probably are correctly seen in the early universe. But the conclusion that is made is that you see these things which couldn't arise from purely magnetic features. They have to be, purely electric, they have to be magnetic. You get curls, which you couldn't have if it was purely electric. Now, Paul Todd was talking to me earlier this year about problems that there were about the creation of primordial magnetic fields, and there are difficulties in ordinary cosmology about where they come from. You apparently see them in magnetic fields in these voids, regions where there are no galaxies. How on earth did the magnetic fields come about? And the view seems to be that they must have been there right from the Big Bang. Mm. And those would produce B modes. Mm. So the idea is not just that the B modes that are claimed to be the smoking gun of inflation and nothing of the sort, but are primordial magnetic fields. And that those magnetic fields, according to the suggestion that Paul made to me, is that maybe they came through from the previous eon, which they would. On this scheme, because they'd be attached to galactic clusters, and those little places where the galactic cluster impinges on the crossover surface, you will have magnetic fields. And then there was just very recently, I was hearing about these things, you see, and was very rather alarmed by the BMOs and the fact that this seemed to be proving inflation, so everybody said, since that would disprove CCC, you see, inflation. Can't coexist with it for various reasons. So I began thinking, well, maybe these are the things Paul's claiming should be there. And then I emailed my colleague, Vahe Gurzajan, who had the person initially who'd seen the evidence of these circular features, concentric circular features, because these would be, each time there's a black hole collision in a galactic cluster, there would be boom, you see, that's one ring. A little bit later, another one, boom, there's another ring. And these would always be concentric, because the central point is where that galactic cluster ends up as. So he was looking at least three rings where the variance, the variation of temperature around the ring, is lower by a certain amount than the average. And this was the test we were using for these things. And he claims to see lots of indications of these things, very non-isotropic over the sky. Certain regions were huge numbers of them, other regions were practically nothing. So when I heard about the B modes, I said, well, I emailed Vahe and says, yeah. Where is this region they're seeing these things? Can you pinpoint it on the sky? So he put a little ring and said, it's in here. And this was in his Planck map. So this was the recent, more recent, the old ones were the W map ones that he looked at, the Planck map ones. And I looked at his picture, nothing whatsoever in there. So I thought, oh dear. So I looked back at the older W map ones, same place, and bang, there was a triple of rings right in the middle. So then I emailed Vahe and I said, well, why don't I see them in the Planck data? So he said, oh, well, I'll turn up the volume a bit. Didn't say it quite like that. Looking at slightly lower signals, and there they are, absolutely right in the middle. Moreover, if these are Paul Todd's, if the BMOs really are magnetic fields, and if these rings are really from that galactic cluster in the previous eon, it's only just on the edge, just from the geometry. It has to be where our past light cone hits, where the galactic cluster ends up. And therefore, the temperature of these rings must be average. See, the distant ones, the signals coming towards us, and therefore warmer. The close ones are signals going away from us, and therefore cooler. The ones which are just on the edge would be of average temperature. I look at these rings, they're right, the color coding is green, which means right in the middle. So this is sort of exciting.
Yes, that is. Yeah.
If this is right, when we could make prediction, well, we make the predictions anyway, but we'll see what the, because the Planck data hasn't come out yet on this. And so it looks as though we might make a prediction of the sorts of places to look for where you should see B modes. Because those, if that's right, see, this is the second observational feature of the scheme. But nobody pays any attention to the first one yet. It's been almost completely ignored.
I mean, there were exciting verifications of this that we had last September.
Yes, Christoph Meisner gave a very nice talk where he explained his analysis, which is quite different from Vahe Gurzajan's analysis. And he also saw significant evidence for these rings. Yes.
Yes.
Looked at in a different way, but yes, it's the same feature. But again, no attention paid.
On some slightly different subject of predictions, how do you think things stand on the evidence for quantum mechanical dependence of biological structure in the brain? I mean, this is something else that you've done.
There have been some interesting things in recent years, yes. Well, you see, first, I should explain that, you see, I wrote my book, The Emperor's New Mind, hoping that by the time I got to the end of the book, I would have some inkling of how quantum effects could be relevant to action of the brain, and I couldn't. It kind of petered out there. But it did have the advantage. I mean, I thought maybe I would inspire young people to do physics or something. It was more either ancient retired people who wrote to me, or else it was somebody in other scientific subjects, and one of these was Stuart Hameroff, who did read my book, and he said, well, look, you may not know about these things called microtubules. That's just showing my ignorance. I'd never heard of them at that time. These are the things that in mitosis, when a cell divides, you see the chromosomes being pulled apart, and these microtubules are dragging them apart. They play all sorts of roles in cells generally. but they seem to have a particular role, according to Stuart anyway, Stuart Hameroff, that they play a particular role in consciousness in the brain. And his business, professional activity, is putting people to sleep as an anesthesiologist in Arizona. And so, unlike maybe many of his colleagues who are just interested in putting people to sleep, he's sort of interested in actually what he's doing when he's putting people to sleep. So, and his idea has been, and he tells me that there is now some good evidence that this is the case, that general anesthetics do act on directly on microtubules. So these are little nanoscale tubes, which are in all sorts of, almost all cells in the body, and in neurons. But the argument is that they have a different role in neurons, and that they play a central role in consciousness. Something very interesting has come up on, well, several things. One is some observation about where you can track where the consciousness kind of appears, what part of the brain is involved. And one thing that always worried me for a long time about most explanations of consciousness in terms of computation or something is, why is the cerebellum not conscious? It seems to be entirely unconscious. Yet there are about half as many neurons as in the brain, and far more connections between neurons in the cerebellum than in the cerebrum. Yet the cerebrum seems to be where consciousness comes about. Well, these new observations have to do with these things called pyramidal cells, pyramidal cells, which are particularly, they're sort of cells which look like pyramids, I suppose. But they don't occur in the cerebellum at all. They occur in a certain part of the brain, which is now identified as a major part where consciousness does come about. And they are absolutely packed with microtubules, apparently. So this is one interesting development. It sort of alters the picture somewhat. But I've always been worried by why the cerebellum, with all these connections and so on, why isn't that indicate, why is that unconscious? But it seems to be it doesn't have these particular types of cells, and that may be a crucial thing. But the other important development has to do with the experimental findings of Anirban Bandyopadhyay, who has been doing experiments largely in Japan with colleagues. He's an Indian doing experiments there. And on individual microtubules, where they measure the resistance with particular frequencies, he finds that there are very particular frequencies where the thing becomes extremely conductive in ways which are quite unlike classical conduction. You see, I had the complicated roundabout route for thinking that quantum mechanics has to be playing a role, and not just quantum mechanics, but beyond quantum mechanics. See, it's not just outrageous. Because people used to think, oh, well, brain is all wet and messy, and how can you have coherent quantum mechanics going on there? But I'm saying not only that, it's got to be at the level, extended to the level where you start to see divergence from standard quantum mechanics. Yeah. Now, that's totally outrageous, you see. But my reasoning came from the Gödel things, and saying, well, it really seems that our understanding cannot be something of a purely computational character. And it's very interesting because, of course, with Turing, it seemed that in his early years he was very...
I think he would have been very alive to these questions, and much more than people who followed
his
computational model
Because he wrote this paper on ordinal logics, and which was trying to, you know, go and beyond systems. And
yeah, I mean, it's very difficult to tell. I mean, I think the success of computational methods during the war really got him going to explore how much you could go in that direction. But he was certainly worried about the fact that physics is actually quantum mechanical.
He was alive to that in a way
that other people not exposed to.
But then you see, normally one would think you could compute at least to any degree of accuracy, as a sort of argument that Turing himself would make, that what the Schrodinger equation does. But then in standard quantum mechanics, you then have to use the Schrodinger equation only as probabilistic. But then you have to have a measurement.
Well, he was very aware of the reduction.
Yes, that's
that
right.
Being rule two. You got that directly from von Neumann. Which is probably also how you would
I was
right from first principle.
Aware of that very much. So, but what's interesting is that now, in biology, it's not just in these microtubules, because that's Bandyopadhyay's observations, which do seem to indicate something very strange is going on in microtubules. which certainly is not classical. And how you explain it quantum mechanically, well, that's, people don't even know how to explain high temperature superconductivity properly yet. So there are lots of things to understand there. But now we know photosynthesis involves entanglements, essentially quantum mechanical effects. Some things about bird navigation, is it? I think it is, yeah, something. And sensitivity to magnetic fields or something. These things do seem to tell us that there is a lot more going on in biology which you simply can't explain purely classically, apart from chemistry, which is already quantum mechanical. But you see, I'm saying you've got to have enough quantum mechanics that it's coherent across many neurons in a way which allows sufficient displacement of mass according to the scheme that I tried to develop with. Well, Dioshi originally had a scheme like this, and then with different motivations I picked up on an idea very similar, which is that when in superpositions, if there's enough mass displacement, then it goes over into classical alternatives. But this is very frowned upon by most quantum mechanics people, because they think that quantum mechanics has to hold invariably at all levels. But all experiments to date have only been at a level where you don't probe this area. So there's experiments hiding in the wings there too.
Well, thank you very much, Roger, for giving this time. Well, time again, time is dominating our
Well, it's been a great pleasure for me. Yeah, it's always a pleasure to talk about these things and try to rake up ideas.
And maybe inspire someone who's watching this to think.
It would be nice. Yes, it would be really nice.
Who knows? Yeah. Right.